We've got a special guest with at the top of the show. Miko Peled is an Israeli-American activist, author, and speaker from a prominent Zionist family with deep ties to Israel's founding, including his grandfather, Avraham Kasnelson, who signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. He served in Israel's special forces, but later rejected Zionism and became a vocal advocate for Palestinian rights, the BDS movement, and a single democratic state with equal rights for all. He currently serves as director of Palestinian House of Freedom in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Miko Peled. How are you, buddy?
Good to be with you. Thank you. Last time I saw you was at a comedy show here in D.C. with Max Blumenthal.
Oh, yes. That was a fun time. I loved it there.
That's
great,
right,
great to see you again. So tell me your story. So you're an Israeli. You served in the IDF. Your father signed the Israel's Declaration of Independence. So how did you go from being a Zionist in the IDF to being an advocate for Palestinians?
Well, it was my grandfather that signed. My father was a general in the Israeli military. So,
got it. Okay, thank you.
I come from a very patriotic line of people, a very patriotic Zionist family. And, I wrote this book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and that kind of became my nickname, The General's Son, in a way. But the way the path that I took was the path of somebody who grows up in this very privileged sphere and suddenly realizes that he lives in this kind of a bubble, you know, in on the privileged side of what is actually an apartheid system. And the journey that I took was a journey from that reality into the space where Palestinians live within Palestine. And eventually I realized, I mean, this went on for several years, but eventually I realized that I wasn't born and raised in a country called Palestine. Israel. I was born and raised in a country called Palestine, which is occupied by a regime that calls itself Israel. So that's kind of the short version of the story, of the journey.
I mean, so you were able to break out of the bubble. So you're saying that you think most people who live in Israel who are brought up there, they live in an information bubble?
It's not that they live in an information bubble, but the education system, the Zionist education system, which is very similar to the Zionist education system here as well in the United States, and the atmosphere and the discourse within society and the discourse in the media is so inherently racist and supremacist that you don't see the Palestinians. You know what I mean? You know that they're there, you know that they're terrorists, you know that they want to kill us, you know that they're kind of primitive, and you know all the stereotypes that, you know, all the characteristics that are given to the other by people who are basically white supremacists. And that's all they know, and that's all they care to know. And of course it's you're told that it's very dangerous to go into Palestinian spaces. And so, for example, I was born in Jerusalem, which is, you know, kind of, they call it a mixed city, but the two sides, the Israelis and Palestinians, it's so segregated, completely segregated, that you don't see Palestinians. In those days, Palestinians still did a lot of the construction. They did a lot of the landscaping. Now they bring in people from other countries. But you see them coming in and out of the frame, but you don't really meet Palestinians. And this is true throughout all of historic Palestine and all of the so-called mixed cities, like Lod, Haifa, of course, Jerusalem, Jaffa, some of the others. The segregation is absolute. And so that's what Israelis know, and that's all they care to know.
And so can you recall what was it that made you realize this as an IDF soldier, that you were taking part in something like this and that it was the exact opposite of what you were taught?
Well, I mean, I was an IDF soldier over 40 years ago, so that was a very long, you know, very, very long time ago. And, during my service, Israel's first invasion into Lebanon in 1982, which was a wake-up call for a lot of people of my generation. Suddenly, you know, the claim was it was going to be a quick incursion in order to get rid of some terrorists. And before you knew it, Israeli forces were in Beirut or the outskirts of Beirut and bombing the city. So it was very clear very quickly that we were being lied to. And then from there, step by step, I mean, I didn't get into really acting issue, although it lived in my family. I didn't really get be part, I wasn't really part of it until much later in life, till around the year 2000 to 2001. It was obvious at that point that this whole mythology around the Israeli army, and again, my father was a general in 1967, so that's like the apex of the mythology. It was clear that there was no morality in that army, that there was no morality within the state or regime, as I like to call it now, because it was all based on lies, and it was all based on the massacre of Palestinians and the displacement of Palestinians.
And so when, you know, we hear over and over that the IDF is the most moral army in the world, and you're saying that that's 100% fabrication?
Well, let's put it this way. So the state of the so-called state of Israel was established in 1948. And the events between 1947 and 1949 are considered by Israelis to be a big part of their identity. And the events of those years are considered heroic, historic, you know, aren't enough words to describe how significant they are to the identity of Israelis. Now, what were these events? It was a massive campaign of genocide and ethnic cleansing, at the end of which an apartheid regime was put in place throughout Palestine. So, and then the militias that existed and did most of that work, committed most of these crimes, then became the Israeli army. So that's the starting point. Now, as we look, you know, as we look almost eight decades later, we see a pattern of initiating wars, of assaulting their neighbors, of displacing Palestinians, of massacring Palestinians more and more and more as the years go by. And then we realize, wait, Palestinians never had an army. You know, Palestinians never posed a threat to anyone. They certainly never had a tank or a fighter plane or anything like that. And so you can see there's a pattern of creating instability, creating war, creating suffering. And that's the legacy of the Israeli military. And that's really the legacy of the entire state of Israel. So it was never moral, and it couldn't be moral, because its main purpose was to execute the policies of ethnic cleansing and genocide of another people.
So, I mean, that's how I didn't really know much about the Israeli history until October 7th, right? And now I know about what you just described, which was, you're describing the Nakba, correct?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And they call it, the Zionists call it the War of 1948, right?
They call it the War of Independence.
Oh, okay. That's what they call it.
But even more, yeah.
But it wasn't really a war, right?
No. It was a campaign that began, you know, many years before that, of mostly terrorist attacks against Palestinian civilians. And gradually, you know, again, I don't want to get too much into the history, but after November of 1947, when the United Nations basically gave their stamp of approval to the establishment of the State of Israel, it went, it was hyped, and it was full force ethnic cleansing and genocide for, you know, till, you know, late in 1949. And, you know, some of Palestine, it continued until 50-51. So it was several years that the Nakba took place, and it was, that's what it was. Now, at some point, other Arab armies tried to intervene and help the Palestinians, but they were in no shape to, and they were not really a match for the Zionist forces. But yeah, though it's not a war. It was the calling it a war is absolutely disingenuous. This was a campaign of ethnic cleansing, of conquest, and of genocide, without any question.
And so, what you actually came to the United States as a young man, correct? And you were shocked to hear the casual racism from your fellow Jewish people that you were hanging out with in the United States. Is that correct? Do I have that right?
I was, the first thing I felt was a real disconnect with the kind of mainstream American Jews. Eventually I found my, you know, friends who were progressive and so forth. But yes, and then in speaking, especially after there would be some kind of an event, after, you know, something came up in the news where Israelis were hurt, then the racism, the Islamophobia was, and people thought they could speak freely around me because they assumed that I agree with them. And so I had to make a few corrections in some of the things that they said and stand up and said, excuse me, you know, this is not, this kind of talk is unacceptable. And it's basically not true besides being racist. But Zionism is inherently white supremacy. So now looking back, you know, if we see it in that frame, then it's really not surprising.
Yeah, and so these were American Jews you're speaking of right now that were had these.
Yes.
And did that shock you that American Jews felt that way, or did you expect it?
Did it shock me? It did surprise me. I mean, everybody knows that the Jewish Zionist community in America supports Israel, and they are very loyal to the idea of Zionism, to the Zionist ideology. And so, but when you hear it, it's shocking, it's surprising. Even if you expect it, even if you know it's there, once you actually hear the rhetoric, it is very disturbing. I mean, even today, when you hear some of the Zionists here in America speaking, particularly Jewish ones, it's very disturbing.
So, are you seen as a traitor then? Do most of the Jews you grew up with and the ones you knew in the United States, do they see you as a traitor?
I don't know. We'd have to ask them. I mean, a traitor, self-hating Jew. I mean, all those kinds of, you know, those terminology that was created by the Zionists. I suppose they might see me that way. Yes, I mean it's really a question of, you know, are you loyal to a tribe or are you loyal to values? You know what I mean? And in my case, I decided to be loyal to values rather than it's not even a tribe. Israeli society is really a new creation, but rather than to be loyal to that and to uphold the crimes of my fathers, so to speak. I found my core values to lead me in another direction, obviously.
Can you speak to that? What kind of society Israel is? It's not, is it made up of people who have a right to that land, or is it made up of people who have no cultural connection to that land and come from Eastern Europe and other parts of the world? Can you speak to that?
Yes, sure. So, I mean, Israeli society, I often compare it to white South Africans. They exist now. They're the result of settler colonialism and racism and some horrible crimes that were committed against the Palestinian people. And so they had no right to the land. I mean, the whole thing, you can trace it back really to this, what's known as the Balfour Declaration, where a British foreign minister who was a white supremacist promised a Jewish millionaire who was also a white supremacist a land that belongs to people who are not white, people who are not European. And from there, that's really when the whole thing got it, you know, received its main impetus. And there is no connection. Somehow the assumption that all Jews today are descendants from the ancient Hebrews is ridiculous. And I don't think there's a Jew alive anywhere that can trace their roots back to Palestine, except for the communities that were there. There were small communities of Jewish people in Palestine. They were Palestinian Jews, but not you know, Israeli society has very little connection to any of those. So no, there is no historic, so what the Zionists did very early on, in order to create the mythology, they said, well, Jewish people are a nation. According to Jewish law, to Jewish scripture, the Jewish people are only united as a people by their faith. And this is something that rabbis have written and said for over 1,000 years. What the Zionists said, no, this is nonsense. We are all the same nation. And our history book is the Old Testament. Forget God and all that, because they were all secular. They didn't want anything to do with religion, but they said all this God and religious stuff is nonsense. This is our history book. And our homeland is Palestine. So now you have a country, you have a history, and you have a people, and it's all made up. It was all completely made up. There was absolutely nothing in common between, say, my grandparents who came from Russia and Jews in Yemen or North Africa or in Iraq. Nothing in common, except that the people who were observant Jews followed the same Jewish laws. But there was nothing in common. And we saw, and we can still see, Israeli society is really a patchwork of different people tied up in scotch tape, and every so often the scotch tape falls off, and you got to kind of, you know, reapply it. But there is no real connection, historic connection. It's all mythology.
So you know, when they say all this land was promised to us 2,000 years ago, that they're twisting. You said they're twisting the Bible, or they're not. And that by the, you know, we've said this on the show before, you just said it again, that the original Zionists and lots of them, they weren't religious people at all. They were godless. Yet they, you know, there's a meme that goes around that these atheistic Zionists don't believe in God, but they're sure God promised them this land, which is kind of...
Yeah, that's a quote from Ilan Pape. Yeah, my good friend, Ilan Pape, who's a historian. So first of all, my first reaction to that is, who cares what the Bible says? That has no bearing whatsoever on politics, on settler colonial. I mean, who cares what the Bible said? Let's say that the Bible said in big letters, God promised Jews this land. So what? What has that got to do with anything? You know, if you believe it, you believe it. You don't believe it, that's fine. But it has no bearing on anything, really. Who cares? And why people keep bringing it up as though it's relevant is really, it's impossible to understand, you know? And we also know that other settler colonial societies use the Bible to justify their crimes. And so, taking other people's land, the land of people who are not white. But regardless, if you do read the scripture, the covenant between God and Abraham mm-hmm. was an agreement. It was not a gift, number one. Number two, Arabs are also descendants of Abraham. So the land is really promised to them as well. So to try to kick them out, to say he gave it only to us. But the entire conversation about what God said or didn't say, or what the Bible says or doesn't say, who cares? What relevance does it even have to what is happening today? You know, and to try to take the conversation to that is so ridiculous. And it's really gaslighting. It's what the Zionists do all the time. Yes, but God said so. Well, who cares what God said? If there is a God, that's a whole other conversation. Right now, over the last 100 years, there's been a reign of terror under which the Palestinians have had to live and endure, and an apartheid regime, which is a crime against humanity, and ethnic cleansing, which is a crime against humanity, and genocide, which of course is a crime against humanity. So we have this regime committing all these crimes, and people are talking about whether or not God promised somebody some land. I mean, it's really crazy that people even have this conversation as though it has any relevance.
And so I heard Tucker Carlson point this out to Mike Huckabee, that when the Bible, it says, you know, he who blesses Israel shall be blessed, that doesn't refer to the political state country invented by the UN called Israel. That is not this. Those are not the two same Israels. The country, the state, the political faction, the Zionist state of Israel is not the same as the Israel that God's speaking about in the Bible. Can you talk about that at all?
Well, of course not. The state of Israel, this regime of horror that has been, you know, occupying Palestine for almost 100 years, is a branch of white supremacist settler colonialism. That's what it is. What a God may or may not have said to somebody in a Bible, you know, a million years ago or whatever, I don't know what relevance that has to today, except that Christian Zionists throughout the 19th century and then Jewish Zionists, or particularly the Jewish Zionists, knew that that was something that would get the Christian Zionist support. And so they, even though the Jewish Zionists hated religion, didn't want anything to do with Judaism, in fact, one of the famous statements of one of the founders, one of the first leaders of Zionism, was that a Zionist is the opposite of a Jew, because a Jew is weak and miserable and ugly, and a Zionist is proud and strong and good-looking. I mean, these are quotes. And so, but they knew that the Christian Zionists, if they wanted their support, then this idea of God promising the land and all that nonsense is somehow is a good point to keep pushing. And they have been, and they're still doing it. They're still talking about this. And my point is, over and over again, number one, it's ridiculous to assume or to state that the Israelis today or the Jews around the world today are somehow descendants of the ancient Hebrews. You know, the Jews as a religion, Judaism wasn't really formed until much, you know, until Jews were in exile after, you know what I mean? It was all created in, most of it was created in exile, the Talmud and so forth, the very laws by which define Jews and define Judaism as a faith, were all created much, you know, later by Jews who lived in different places, in Baghdad, and some were in Jerusalem, some were, of course, in Europe, and so on. And if you look at me, you know, or look at Israelis, you know, who are also, you know, I mean, do we look like we come from the Middle East? I mean, it's completely ridiculous. And again, who cares what the Bible says or doesn't say? Why does it matter? And why in the world does that give anybody legitimacy to do what Israel does?
I mean, I agree with you. So you talk about, can you just tell me a little bit about, it's kind of shocking for me when I would get insights into the mentality of the people living in Israel, the Israelis, the Zionists, how they would set up lawn chairs and as a watch, like almost a sporting event, watch them carpet bomb the Palestinians in Gaza. What is the mentality? They don't see the Palestinians as humans. They almost see them as, you know, target practice for fun. What can you speak to the mentality?
It's a racist society. It's a society that's inherently racist. I mean, look, the polls over the last, you know, since October 7, and Israeli public opinion is almost 100% behind the genocide of people who live in the Gaza concentration camp. It's almost 100% support. And when there is some dissent, it's usually because the killing is not enough. And so that's the discourse in that society. That's been the discourse in that society from the beginning. And like I said, it's a society that was born out of a terrible crime, which is the Nakba. It's a society that's not only executed that, I mean, my parents' generation executed it, but their parents who immigrated to Palestine, who came to colonize Palestine, they put together this ideology, this racist, genocidal ideology that somehow Jewish people have the right to come to Palestine and then create this apartheid regime and completely, completely wipe out the Palestinians. And so as we look at massacres in the 50s and 60s and 70s and on and on and on, there's always some, you know, it's always treated like it was, well, what are you going to do? I mean, you got to do what you got to do kind of thing, you know? It's really a gangster mentality. But this is the society. This is the society. And it's been like that from the very beginning. Any dissent beyond a certain point is unacceptable. Anybody who talks, I'll give you an example. My father retired from the military after 1967, so 1968. But while still in uniform, immediately after the 1967 Israeli assault against its neighbor, they call it the Six-Day War, but really it was an unprovoked, unnecessary assault. Immediately after the war was done, in the very first meeting of the Israeli High Command, he said, now we can make peace with the Palestinians. Because, like it or not, there's another nation here. We can give them the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and they can have their own state, and we can move on. And from that point on, he became an outcast. And even when he would come, and then for years he was one of the big promoters of the idea of the two-state solution based on that. And he would come to the United States very often and speak. When he came as a general, he was adored and welcomed and so forth. When he retired, he became somebody who wants to promote this idea of a two-state solution and peace and recognition of Palestinian rights, he could not get a meeting with a staffer if he came to Washington. I mean, nobody wanted to speak to him. And his point was, America needs to stop sending money and weapons to Israel. It does nothing good. A nation that wants peace does not buy so many weapons. And stop giving them weapons, stop giving them money. He said this basically until the day he died in 1995. And so that's where this insanity comes from. A man who was a Zionist till his dying day and a general and fought in all these famous wars and was part of the Israeli military establishment for a long time immediately became an outcast for daring to suggest that Palestinians have any rights and that a small portion of historic Palestine be provided for the Palestinian to, you know, as an expression of their right to self-determination. And he became, like I said, an outcast. So he already crossed the line just by saying that. That's kind of what kind of dissent is not permitted in the discourse within Israeli society.
So when you say he became an outcast, I mean, what happens to people? What is the social price paid by Israelis and other Jews who abandon the Zionist cause like that?
Well, again, he didn't abandon the Zionist cause. He just thought that there needs to be some compromise on the land. I mentioned this in the book. Like, my mother would say, suddenly, you know, their friends stopped inviting them. You know, their friends would have gatherings. They had all these friends, you know, for many, many years, and many of them were also former military people. And he was considered almost a traitor, you know, and his views were not heard, and he would not be, you know, he was known to be somebody who needs to be excluded from whatever, you know, whether it's social or political or anything like that. I mean, he still wrote and he still, you know, he was okay, but he was considered completely a persona non grata, completely. And even here in the United States.
Really? Okay. So now, so your father advocated for a two-state solution, giving the Palestinians the Gaza and the West Bank, but you don't support that. Do you? Do you support the two-state solution, and what is the solution?
No. I mean, the issue is not whether I support or not support. The issue is, number one, how the hell is it going to work? There's no West Bank. It's been completely integrated, except for ghettos within which Palestinians live in what used to be the West Bank, in that area that is, you know, marked on the map. Palestinians live in ghettos, almost 4 million Palestinians. But other than those ghettos, everything else is full of cities and towns and universities and shopping malls for Jews only. So Israel built immediately after it took the West Bank in 1967, it built massively for Israeli Jews only. And we're not talking about villages or farms. We're talking about massively buildings, cities, billions of dollars invested. So how's it going to work? I mean, what are you going to, you know, there's no West Bank. There's really no way to divvy up the country. And the two Israelis and Palestinians live very close to each other geographically, even though they're completely segregated, very effectively segregated. There's no way to splice the country. That's number one. Number two, let's say we talk about a two-state solution today. Initially, the determination was that the Palestinians get the small portion of their homeland and the Zionist colonizers get the lion's share. But how is that determined? Maybe it should be the other way around. So how do you determine who gets what part of the country? You know, again, it's an absurd, it's kind of an absurd assumption to begin with. And the third point is, what are the virtues of having two states as opposed to creating a real democracy with equal rights, which is the Palestinian, which is the original Palestinian platform going back decades, is a creation of a democracy with equal rights that respects all religions and all people and so forth. So today, when we talk about the choices, two-state solution is no longer a choice. It's ridiculous to even talk about it. Although here in Washington, D.C., people talk about it as though it was a serious option. The options are, we maintain our support for this cruel apartheid genocidal regime called Israel, or we fight to dismantle it and replace it with a free Palestine with equal rights, allowing the right of the refugees, or putting in mechanisms to allow the Palestinian refugees to return. So these are the two choices. And so I always say it's not a political issue, it's an issue of values. If somebody wants to support the state of Israel, then they need to own it and own the fact that they are supporting genocide, they're supporting apartheid, they're supporting horrific crimes against humanity. Own it. If you're willing to say, I'm a Zionist, own it. That's what Zionism is. There's no other Zionism. Now, if we believe in humanity, in human rights, in equality, in justice, in democracy, and all these things that people like to say they believe in, then there's no way to support Zionism. The Zionist regime has to be dismantled and replaced. And, you know, elections have to be called, one person, one vote, and a real democracy, a real free democratic Palestine needs to take its place. Those are really the only two options that exist today. And here at Palestine House of Freedom, which I, you know, founded and I'm the director of, founded, I should say, along with Palestinian comrades, that's what we talk about. That's what we educate about. That's what we do our outreach about. That's what we hold events about. We have a lot, very large space here on Capitol Hill, not really close to the Capitol. We're working on our curriculum and so forth. So everything we do is geared toward getting people to understand there is a solution that benefits everyone. And that solution is dismantling apartheid and establishing a free Palestine with equal rights and on all of historic Palestine. The country, you'll see it in your eyes. You'll see it with your very eyes. The discrimination, the segregation, the anti-Palestinian policies, the different bureaus that exist in order to govern the Palestinians, who are citizens of Israel, I'm not talking about the West Bank or Gaza, is such a complicated, complex web of bureaucracy. So if I go back, I can go back, I'm a citizen, I can live there, I can do whatever I like. Okay, I was born and raised in Jerusalem. A Jerusalemite Palestinian can't go back if he leaves or if he has a second passport. Palestinian Jerusalemites who can trace, many of who can trace their ancestry going back 800 years in the city itself, are residents. They're not citizens. Palestinians who live in the Galilee, in northern Palestine, are governed by, and it's a majority Palestinian actually in the Galilee, and there's a very strong push called Judaizing the Galilee. They are governed by a special ministry, which is, they call it development of the Galilee. Development means taking land from Palestinians. In the Naqab, which is the entire southern half of Palestine, you have some 300,000 Palestinian Bedouin more than half of which live without water, roads, access to education, access to electricity, access to medical care, and on and on and on and on. Their homes are being demolished at an unbelievable rate, and so forth. And they are governed by a different bureaucracy. Israeli Jews in settlements in the southern Naqab, which is, it's a desert, but it's a very fertile desert, enjoy one of the highest living standards within Israelis, because it's such a fertile land there. And you've got farms, and you've got ranches, and you've got kibbutzim, and you've got all kinds, you've got cities, and so on. The Palestinian Bedouin are the poorest of the poor. To claim that somehow Palestinians have equal rights, I remember people used to say this about apartheid South Africa, that actually the black people are doing quite well, and they have a member of parliament, and they have a judge, and you know, and that somehow the claim that because some people within the oppressed society have been fortunate enough or have collaborated enough in order to be allowed some privilege, it doesn't mean that the racism doesn't exist. So you've got a whole bunch, several different bureaucracies that govern the lives of Palestinians, but the most prominent one is the Shabak, the Israeli secret police. You cannot get a driver's license, you can't get a mortgage, you can't get a job, you can't do anything unless you get the approval of the secret police first. And these are for citizens. Now there's about 2 million Palestinian citizens of Israel, as they say, as they call them. And their cities are, if you know, they're denied water. That's the biggest part. Israel controls all the water. Palestinians throughout all of Palestine, so some 7.5 million Palestinians, and maybe 6.5 or so billion Israelis, they're given 3% of the water. Three. So when you drive up and down the country, you see the Palestinian towns, and I'm talking about within what's called Israel proper, and then you see the Israeli settlements and modern cities and so forth, you see the difference. Unless you understand that they're not getting water, unless you understand that there are no plans for infrastructure, for growth, there are, you know, unless you understand the politics and the policies that apply to Palestinians, it's impossible to understand why Palestinians live in these conditions. And it goes back to the apartheid regime. It is an absolute apartheid regime. There is no equality for Palestinians anywhere throughout Palestine. It's an absolute lie.
And let me just ask you one final question. You know, you mentioned that, you know, Israel started with the Balfour Declaration, which gave them the right to the land, but it was given to them by the UK, which also didn't have a right to that land. They were illegally occupying it, and then they gave it. So what was in it? Can you tell me the history? Why did the UK want to give the Balfour Declaration to the Zionists?
Well, the Balfour Declaration is a very short letter that was written by Lord Balfour, who was the foreign minister of the United Kingdom, to a Jewish millionaire by the name of Rothschild. And in this short letter, he says that the United Kingdom views favorably the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, and that this should not infringe upon the rights of the non-Jews. Now, there were very few Jewish people in Palestine at the time, and there was a vast majority of Muslims and some Christians. To refer to the Palestinians as the non-Jews, I mean, you understand what they're already saying there? The Jews are somehow a priority. So basically what I said earlier, you have one white supremacist giving another white supremacist a land that belongs to other people completely. They have no right to whatsoever. Neither one of them has any connection or any right to Palestine. Why they did it, you know, is a long story, and I don't know if we want to get into that. But that is what the Balfour Declaration is, and that gave the impetus to say, well, the British support it, and so now we're going to go, and it's going to be, and of course it was the beginning of the British support for the Zionist colonization of Palestine, without any question.
So, what was in it for the UK to do that? I mean, what did they get out of ceding that land to the Zionists?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Balfour was a rabid anti-Semite, and so I guess one advantage was to get rid of the Jews. Another advantage is to have a European colony in the region, in Western Asia, in Palestine. And they really believed that, you know, the phrase, a land without a people. They knew that there were people there. Everybody knew. I mean, they did commerce with Palestine. They visited Palestine. Palestine was a thriving country. But these people were not people that counted because they were not white. And so it's racism. It's settler colonialism. I mean, we can ask why there's settler colonialism anywhere. Why does one side support the other? You know, these are questions for books have been written about this. But I think the Zionists, at the end of the day, the Zionists were very clever in that they saw how they can use Christian Zionists and Christian evangelicals who read the Bible literally and still do, and get them on board. And that was the success of that generation of Zionists.
And so have you heard the theory that the Balfour Declaration was a payback for the Jews for getting America involved in World War I? Have you heard that theory?
I've heard the theory. I've not seen any real evidence. And I spoke to some historians who know the issue very well. And the evidence is tenuous, but it could be. It could have been part of it. I mean, it was well known already that Jews held Jewish people and held important positions of power in the United States and money and so forth. But I have to also say that in those days, the vast majority of American Jews rejected Zionism. The vast majority of Jews around the world rejected Zionism. So that's a big part of the story that is often forgotten. The Reform Movement, which is the largest kind of Jewish movement, Jewish organization, they were inherently deeply anti-Zionist. The ultra-Orthodox Jews were inherently deeply anti-Zionist. So to connect the two makes no sense if you understand where Jews initially stood on the issue of Palestine, on the issue of Zionism.
So that was quite a magic trick then for the Zionists to pull that off, to get, whereas most of the Jews were against Zionism, it seems like, and now most of the Jews are for Zionism. Is that a correct statement? And how did they pull that off?
I don't know that most Jews, but what the Zionists understood is that education is the key. So if we look at Jewish institutions where the big Jewish communities existed on the East and West Coast, they had their own. The European Jews had their own European culture. They had they spoke Yiddish. They wrote in Yiddish. They had newspapers and theater and so on. That was a thriving culture. And gradually the Zionists came in and slowly but surely killed it, started building what they call like Jewish day schools or Jewish high schools and so on, which are private Zionist schools. And they exist throughout the country and they've done a great job. And so they eliminated and the Zionists looked down at Yiddish. They looked down at Jewish culture. They looked down at anything that reminded them of Jews. And so they very successfully replaced that culture with Zionism, to the point where really Zionism is the religion of the Zionist Jews. And so I wouldn't say that most Jews are Zionists. I would say the large communities with the big bullhorns are Zionists. And even that now is breaking up. I mean, this is, we're at a point now where there's some serious fractures within those communities. But then you have many Jews who are completely, don't really care one way or the other. And then you've got large Jewish communities everywhere around the world that are very deeply anti-Zionist. And that part and those communities are growing very rapidly, and particularly after October 7th. And so it was a magic trick, but the Zionists were zealots. They believed in the cause. And regardless of what differences they may have had among them, and they had many politically, some were socialists, some were religious, some were right wing, some were this. But when it came to the issue of the state, and I remember this as a kid, in the family gathering, the state was everything. They line up and they plan ahead. And we can see as the movement or the constituency that supports the liberation of Palestine, we're always 100 years back, 100 years behind. Now we're closing in a little bit. but they are so far behind. They foresaw, for example, that Zionism is going to be equated with racism. So they created a new definition of anti-Semitism that includes if you reject Zionism. Who the hell are they to define anti-Semitism anyway? But now, across this country and across the West in general, that new definition has taken hold, and that is brought up as the definition of anti-Semitism. So if you reject Zionism, you're an anti-Semite, which is complete nonsense. Complete nonsense. Because if you look at Jewish scripture, Zionism is inherently a violation of Jewish law. But so that's the impression that people have, that most Jews are Zionists. But I don't believe that, not for one minute.
So what do you say? Like, I have Jewish friends who say that I'm a Zionist, but I don't support the Greater Israel Project, and I believe in equal rights for Palestinians. And what I say back to those people is, then you're not a Zionist. How would you agree with that? And how do you define Zionism?
Well, Zionism defined itself. It's people who believe that all Jews around the world have a right to Palestine at the expense of Palestinians. I mean, it's very simple. That's what Zionism is. And if anybody has any doubt what Zionism is, we have a 100-year history of Zionism in Palestine. We see what the Zionists have done in Palestine. So we don't have to, sit here with theories and philosophies. There is proof on the ground. There's a 100-year almost history of Zionism in Palestine. And what have we seen? We've seen suffering and killing and all these horrific crimes that the Zionists have committed systemically, not like a bad apple here or there, but systemically. That's what Zionism is. There's no other Zionism. So like I said earlier, if you claim to be a Zionist, this is it. If you reject that, then the other option is to reject Zionism completely, just like we reject white supremacy, just like we reject anti-Semitism, and on and on and on and on. Zionism is in the same column, so to speak, as white supremacy and other forms of racism, including anti-Semitism. So people have to make a choice, and they don't like to. So they kind of look for some kind of a gray area. But there's no gray area when it comes to racism. You're either a racist or you reject racism.
And is that your message to American Jews? What or do you have one for American Jews?
Well, I think American Jews should look back at their roots and find out just how strongly Jews rejected Zionism in the beginning, and go back to that. It was based on values. And for religious people, it was based on religion. People who are, observant Jews, the rejection of observant Jews, which still goes on today in many places, is based on faith, is based on the Jewish scripture. So whether you're secular or religious, if you look back at the roots, you will see all the good reasons to reject Zionism and liberate Palestine, because they go hand in hand.
So the Hasidics, correct me if I'm wrong on this, because there's a good chance I am, that they see the state of Israel as being a blaspheme because, according to their biblical text, they say that they're supposed to wait for the Messiah to come back, and then they establish the homeland. But they're doing it before the Savior comes. Do I have that close, or can you explain that?
Well, it's so, according to the faith, according to Judaism, the Jews sinned and were therefore expelled. Because, like I said earlier, the deal was they get to remain in the Holy Land if they observe God's laws. They didn't. They sinned. They were expelled. And they're not allowed to return until such day that the Almighty shows them that it's okay to return, and that hasn't happened. Now, it's not about sovereignty. It's about worship. The craving of Jews throughout the world for, to come back to Jerusalem and so forth, it's not about sovereignty. It's not about a state. It's not about a homeland. Jews have homelands throughout the world. Wherever Jews live, that's where they are. You have American Jews, or Mexican Jews, and on and on and on. It's about worship. And the day that the Messiah comes, everybody will worship the Lord, and they will turn their swords into plowshares, and there will be no more war, and that sort of thing. That's the vision of what will happen. It's not about coming in and creating sovereignty and a modern state over all of Palestine. It has nothing to do with that. It's all about worship. And the scriptures very clearly state that Jews are prohibited from mass return and or taking over the Holy Land. And I'll just tell you a little story. There's a great anti-Zionist rabbi in the UK. His name is Rabbi Beck, Elchanan Beck. He's very outspoken. And there was an interview with him. And so he takes the reporter into the synagogue, and the reporter says to him, how is Zionism, you know, a violation of Jewish faith? And he takes him to the Ten Commandments, and he sees, you see this? Thou shalt not steal. You see this? Thou shalt not murder. That's it. Because that's what Zionism is all about. So it's really quite simple why observant Jews reject Zionism. And today, you know, they're rejecting the service in the military, and they're supposed to, you know, they changed the laws there. It's a long story, but tens of thousands of young observant Jews are saying, we will not serve in your army. And these are ones that live, you know, in Palestine.
Right, in Israel. All right, well, Mikko Peled, I appreciate you, the author of The General's Son, and he is now the director of Palestine House of Freedom in Washington, D.C. Thanks for making time for us today. I appreciate it very much. Thanks for filling in our audience on what's happening, and best of luck to you. Before we let you go, do you have any predictions on how this is going to end?
How the situation in Palestine is going to end?
Yes.
Well, it's going to end when the apartheid regime is already crumbling. Now, with this reckless attack on Iran, they're paying a very heavy price, and I think it's going to collapse and be replaced by free, liberated Palestine. I think the model of South Africa is what we're going to see more or less in Palestine.
Really? Okay, and what about the nuclear weapons, though, that Israel has, right? So I'm told they have the thing called the Samson option, and if they feel an existential threat to their Jewish supremacist state, that they will do the Samson option and nuke the world. What do you know anything about that?
Well, South Africa had nuclear weapons, too. And on top of that, they had uranium and gold, and they controlled all of Southern Africa. So they were a lot bigger and stronger and wealthier than the state of Israel. But I think at the end of the day, when the realization comes that this is it, they'll see that the sky hasn't fallen, and they will have, they will live in a free democracy for the first time ever. And they'll perhaps have a Palestinian prime minister, and the sky is not going to fall. I think by and large, people will opt for life rather than death and destruction.
Wow. Fingers crossed. I hope so. I really do. I hope you're right about that. Mikko Peled, thank you again very much, and welcome back anytime.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.